Thank you, Jethro. Thank you very much for coming. Glad to be here. Thank you, of course, Rabbi Marwitz, for putting everything together. We have a lot of work to do. And basically, Rabbi Marwitz was saying that we try to do it for you. And as Jethro was trying to explain, the Torah has a list found in Sefer Vayikra and Sefer Devarim, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. And there are 24 birds in total on that list which are forbidden. Any bird not on that list is theoretically kosher. The problem is you cannot identify which birds are the forbidden species, and as a result, you can only eat birds that are sure are not on the list. And the only way to be sure if a bird is not on the list of forbidden species is if this particular bird, the bird that we have, what's called the Misora, as Ezra explained, there's a tradition that the Jewish people have been eating it since ancient times, since when people were still able to identify the 24 forbidden species on the list. Okay? Here, what Rabbi Marwick requested, and that's what we're going to do, is we're going to deal with the specific species of birds. In general, we can identify kosher and non-kosher birds based on one characteristic, whether or not there's a tradition of permissibility. However, the Talmud in Kulin, about 59, if you want to check up on it, lists four characteristics that a person can use, physical characteristics that a person can use to identify that kosher and non-kosher birds. Ezra identified one of them, that it's not a bird of prey. And as Ezra was saying, the idea of a bird of prey is somewhat subjective. The idea is that if you have a bird of prey, in American, you know, verbiage, a predator is a bird such as an eagle, a hawk, a falcon, and there are other birds which are not considered to be a bird of prey, which halachic we are. As Ezra pointed out, the halachic definition of a predator does not follow the scientific definition of a predator. And, for example, we classify as a predator any bird that uses its talons to eat its food, whether it stands on the food while it's eating it, or it takes the food and picks it up and brings it to its mouth. According to Rashi, it doesn't matter what the bird's eating. And I have an example, and many of you are probably familiar with this bird, of a bird which definitely behaves like a predator in every regard, but scientifically, it wouldn't really be considered a predator. And this is not the kind of, I see some people are looking back, and you really don't have to. It's a parrot. And this is actually the only bird I have here that probably you could find in a zoo or something. Everything else is a little more rare. But a parrot, yeah, it's trained, or it's not even operational. But if you take a look at the parakeet, and I don't want to pass it down to people either, but if you took a look at the parakeet, you'll notice that it stands with two toes facing one direction, two toes facing another direction, and that it interlocks its toes around its food when it's eating, and the larger parrots will actually take food in their mouth, pick it up from the ground, and bring it to their mouth. There's a very, very ancient Jewish tradition, which is recorded by someone by the name of Rabbi Sadigon, for those people that are familiar. He predates pretty much all of the scholars that you have from the European scholars, and he was already still in Babylonia, but he was close to you. And he identified one of the forbidden birds on the 24 bird list as actually a parrot. When I was trying to research the different birds, I used to go to the American Museum of Natural History. If you're from New York, you probably have been in the upper part. Everyone has to go on a state trip. I think it's required by law, and I'm just joking, but it seems that way. And upstairs, they have a huge museum where they have, you know, nice stuffed animals and whatever. Underneath, they have these catacombs, rooms that I think they were once some kind of aquifer from when they still did the aquifers. And they're 12 feet high rooms, floor-to-ceiling shelves, and inside they have 9 million stuffed birds and other kinds of animals. And whenever we go, oh, you, we're trying to identify species, we go down to these catacombs with the curator of birds, and we make sure that we're not identifying anything contrary to science. Because obviously, if the science is telling us this is something, and we're not coming up with the same research on our own, then we have to decide what's going on. There also happens to be a law which is one of these laws that nobody knows about, but even on those lists of bizarre laws, this one never makes it, that any bird, migratory bird, that's hit on certain freeways in Long Island, they have to take the bird from autopsy to the museum. And I guess this was a really intelligent law in the days where like the first automobiles were sort of like puffing around these mountain roads somewhere, you know, going down to the Montauk or something. But nowadays it's ridiculous if these birds keep coming into the museum and they've got no idea what to do with them. So if you have a valid scientific reason or anything, any reason whatsoever that you can claim is somewhat scientific, they'll give you access. And I was standing there, pointing to the Rambam, Maimonides. The key difference between a kosher and a non-kosher bird is the stomach. If you cut open the stomach of a kosher bird, and you cut open the stomach of a non-kosher bird, the inner core of the stomach will react differently to the human touch. Which means, if you take your fingers and you rub it on the cut open stomach of a non-kosher bird, the stomach will flake, at most. If you rub your finger with the stomach of a kosher bird, there are two membranes, and they'll separate. So I wanted to see this happen. So they had dead hogs and owls, and I'm going, I'm cutting open all the, they made you wear gloves, so it wasn't that gross. But, you know, cutting open all the stomachs, and they're all, everything is exactly as we expect. And here's a little fact about the American Museum of Natural History, they're all atheists. And at least all the curators are. So they're all sitting there sort of laughing, having a good time. Then finally, after I've been doing this for about 2 hours, they go, you know, Rabbi, people do research on birds. We got books that has all the information you're looking for. I said, I know, it's like, what are you looking for? So I said, well, really, my definition of predator is the definition of predator. Because based on my research, I didn't want to use the word Bible or anything like that, because that's what it means. Where you don't use that institute. I said the parrot and the falcon are the same. And the curator of Berkeley was very surprised about this. He told me that just so happened before what happened. He had just finished decoding the genome of the parrot and the falcon and all these other predators. And science classifies falcons as closely related to hawks, eagles. Look it up in the biology book, whatever the family tree is there. But when they decoded the genome, they discovered that the closest relative of the falcon was actually the parrot. And the museum people were very surprised about this. So they started doing research into the parrot. And they obviously didn't take rocket science to be able to do this. Parrots are vegetarians. Now, of course, vegetarians are relatives. If you watch those videos on your cables, you'll see that vegetarians probably eat more live fish than anybody else, because they kill our meat before we eat it, because they're vegetarians to get what's still happening around. You can watch the video if you want. But parrots are essentially vegetarians. So how could it be related to a falcon, which as you know is exclusively carnivorous? And they started talking to the experts in parrots, and they realized that people who breed parrots, people who breed parrots, let me add the word, for profit, that they make more money the more babies the parrots have. So what they do is they train the birds to eat meat. And if they can get their birds to eat meat, they're much more productive and much healthier and much able to produce more baby parrots. And of course, they also discovered, well, they knew about it, but they were comparing this to these birds in New Zealand called kia. And the kia is actually a carnivorous parrot. So when it comes to identifying the kosher, non-kosher birds, I think as science becomes more advanced, they'll tweak it a little bit and they'll be much more in line with the halakhic definition. But for now, we're going to have to understand that when we say predator, we only know a bird is not a predator if we know that specific bird is not a predator. So if you would take me outside and you would point at the seagull, I know that's a predator because it's only 24. We're not sure which one, but we know the seagull is one of the 24 predator birds. If you've been to the beach, you know why. Right, they'll be jumping in, grabbing things, attacking them, killing them. On the other hand, if you point to, let's say, a robin or a cardinal, or any of the birds that were not found in Europe, so I will not be able to tell you, no one will be able to tell you whether or not it's a predator or not, whether or not we can eat it. One of the few game birds that Jewish people still eat is the quail. The quail, for those of you who familiar with the biblical stories. When the Jews were in the middle of the Sinai Desert, they started complaining because they wanted to eat. At which time the wind came, brought a huge flock of quail. People gathered up the quail and they ate them. So you can say that the quail was back certified by Moses, for sure they know. It also happens, as luck would have it, the quail migrate from North Africa to Europe. And they migrate through Israel, Syria, parts of Babel. So wherever Jews have been living for the last, since there have been Jews in this world, there's always been quail. So it's very easy for the Jewish people to be certain that the quail is kosher, because throughout the diaspora, where they were Jews, it just happened to be, they're also quail. In Europe, there's only one bird that's called quail. And that bird, which I have to apologize, it's not for me to comes in two colors.
They discovered
discovered another species of very small birds, which they also called quail. Those are called button quail now. And in fact, today, I'm always nervous about giving the number, but I know Wikipedia takes a note of which animals are extinct, but I never know if they're 100% accurate. But last time, there were 48 species of non-extinct birds that are called quail. There are also many species of quail that are extinct. But these birds are not related to each other. It just happens to be that people, wherever they went, they would see a bird running on the ground, they would call it a quail. And if you look at old zoological textbooks, you'll see that people call all sorts of things quail. And it seems in many languages, such as English, pretty much anything that ran on the ground that wasn't a chicken was at some point in time the smaller birds. So just knowing that quail is kosher, that doesn't really help us. Right? Because if you say quail's kosher and you go into a store in the United States, if you go into a pet store and you say, could I please buy a quail, they will sell you the button quail, which I'll pull out as soon as I take out the other birds. And on the other hand, if you go to buy meat, because you're a carnivore, and you would like to eat a quail, they will give you either these quail or either the baba or the European quail. And just, I don't know why, they cost the same amount. And on many websites, if you order quail eggs, eat obviously not to raise, they'll have a disclaimer on the bottom saying that the merchant reserves the right to substitute bobwhite quail for European quail, or European quail eggs for bobwhite quail eggs, obviously whichever, at his discretion. So you can see that the name of a species does not really help us identify them. With the quail in particular, science does really, well, science, if you're into the whole, if you're a master of zoologists, you could probably, the science is understanding the species. But if you were to use the way people talk, if you were to talk to farmers, you were to talk to experts, and you're talking about quail, nobody knows what you're talking about. So, as we said before, in order to identify a bird's kosher, you have to know that this bird, not just by its name, but also have someone who knew the bird was kosher, identify the live bird for you. And if someone could identify, well, this bird I can tell you nothing about, this bird I can tell you is kosher. You get a good look at the bird underneath, and you see it's kosher. And you can identify it, so you can go and you can eat it. Now what happens, as many of you know, is that people like to play with nature. People like to manipulate nature. And as time progresses, the different animals get bred for specific characteristics. So these, many of you know anything about chickens or stuff like that. You know there's some chickens that are this big, some chickens that are this big. Because some people want big chickens, some people want small chickens. The quail, they have it in brown, they've made them white. But what also happens is if people continue to change their taste, they've recently, because quail hasn't been really domesticated until recently. The Japanese domesticated quail for about 400 years, but they were only interested in the same. No one's really, domesticated quail as an aesthetic creature. Until now, if farmers want to have the odd animal, they come out with a new kind of quail. It's called the Italian quail or the blonde quail. And the question is this the same species as this or this? And you can come up after, you may go put them on the table, you can judge for yourself. But on the one hand, the colors, even if you're not standing very close to the quail, but you can see that the quail are all very different colors. On the other hand, if you can come up and look closely, don't do that right now, but maybe a few minutes later, you'll see that the quail, the shape of the beak of this quail, is very different than the shape of the beak of this quail, and that these quail happen to have the same basic size. But as I told you before, there are 48 different species of quail. So who's to say that blonde quail was the result of the domestication of the European quail? Maybe it was the result of someone domesticating one of the other 48 species of quail. You're probably thinking, well, why don't we just go to the records and ask the farmer or whoever domesticated them? As you can imagine, whoever has the magic recipe, the genetic recipe for the domestication of these birds, there's a lot of motivation to lie. Because if he tells you how he did it, how he got, let's say, these quail would be like this, then he won't be. And he loses his, you know, his special, whatever he was trying to create. So it can't be really rely on the testimony of people who have invested interest in lying to us. The only way you can figure out these quail are kosher is, first of all, by observing them, seeing if they behave the same, but also comparing them anatomically to the kosher quail and seeing if they match 100%. If they match 100%, and we know the difference between the 48 other species of quail, then we'll be able to determine if these quail were also among the kosher quails. Yes?
Wouldn't you be able to do it genetically? Wouldn't that be much easier?
The question is, how accurate is genetics in determining a species? As you, I don't know if you've delved into genetics. I'm not an expert in genetics. But genetics is good at telling you things such as relationships, but in terms of determining a species, at least on a very fine line, sometimes genetics isn't 100% there. Yeah?
Can you reproduce the experiment on your game girl and see if it comes out to that?
That's the problem. That we're not, theoretically, if we got the recipe, it's not rocket science, right? Let's say the guy says, well, all I did was for 50 years, everyone in my family, you know, just took the most this colored quail out of these quail, and eventually this quail became that. So, you know, it's going to take us a little bit long to replicate the experiment. On the other hand, what he might have done is maybe he took these quail and he threw it. That's why genetics gets a little bit wishy-washy. Maybe he took these quail and he hybridized them with one of the other 48 species of quail. And then in 6 months later, you know, these guys popped out. And that's the issue that we have to determine before we can say it's kosher or not. Yes?
Well, isn't the ultimate definition of a species whether or not they can mate together? That seems something that would be relatively easy.
So that's actually the view of many of the halakhic authorities of the 1850s, the Abenezer, the Chasam Sofer. They define a species as their ability to mate. However, the offspring has to be a very viable offspring, which means that if, for example, there's two kinds of ducks, let's say. You take a muscovite duck and you take a peking duck, and you hybridize them, the majority of their offspring are sterile. So the fact that they can produce an egg that will hatch, that doesn't guarantee us, that doesn't tell us anything about the species if the offspring is not fertile. And what we don't know is what has to be the incidence of fertility. There are some species of chicken, that lives into chicken, such as the Aracuna, where the species itself survives, but the mortality rate of the developing embryo is astronomical. So on the one hand, you might say it's a species. On the other hand, there's something wrong with the genetics. It's not matching well. That's a very good question. Any other questions? The final these are the other quail I was telling you about that you could find if you went to a pet store. And the reality is that there are a lot of similarities between the quail, a lot of differences. What's interesting, though, is that these quail, even though they're tiny, no. Happens that on the way here, these quail laid eggs. And one day I think just but you can't get everything. And what happens is, even though these quail are so small, and these quail nobody thinks are kosher, they're obviously a completely different species than those quail. But the size of the eggs, and please remember that the eggs do not have a consistent color. Get a lot bigger, and these eggs can sometimes be a lot smaller. Sometimes, even if you're saying that you only want to buy these quail, the eggs are similar enough in size and shape that they can often be confused with each other. And this is another question that we often have at the OU, is slaughtering, just for those of you that want to get into the slaughtering lore, slaughtering the kosher quail is a very unprofitable experience because it's obviously there's no meat on it. It's just not a cheerful thing to do. But the eggs are, if the quail are kosher, the eggs are kosher. And on the ethnic markets, for $1.25, you can get a dozen quail eggs. So what a lot of the fancy restaurants like to do at the side of a salad is like to throw on quail eggs. And the big hesitation of Don Yu with allowing this in our restaurants is not because we don't believe that these quail are kosher, but we're scared that maybe when someone goes to buy a quail egg, instead of buying a quail egg from a kosher quail, they're going to accidentally end up buying a quail egg from a non-kosher quail. And they're all sold at the same price in the same market, and who's to say that maybe one or two of the eggs won't be confused? Do you have any questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much for, yes, you have a question?
Why do some Jews not eat turkey?
The question is, why did Jews eat turkey? I eat turkey, so don't worry, I'm not going to come out against it. The question was asked to the Nitziv, Naftali to Yehuda Berlin, and they asked him, is turkey kosher? And I think he really summed up right. If you want to look it up, Meshiv Dover, that's a Shalos and Shivos Tuf Beis. He says, if you ask me first about quail, I'm sorry, about turkey, if you ask me about turkey, before everybody started eating it, I would have said turkey is forbidden. But now that all the Jewish people are eating turkey, how can we say turkey is not kosher anymore? And if he's going to say that it's not kosher, then it's just needed a reason. There are two other reasons, really, why turkey has been accepted as kosher. One reason is because it looks like a chicken. And before people start shooting you over this one, it doesn't look like a chicken on the outside. If you hold a turkey next to a chicken, they don't look alike. What we mean is they look the same from what Ezra was explaining before. They are kosher signs. It just so happens, and I don't understand why, the kosher signs of a turkey are exactly like those of a chicken. If you ignore everything between the beak of the turkey and the foot of the turkey, you'll see that the beak of the turkey is very much a chicken beak, and the foot of the turkey is very similar to the foot of a turkey. In addition, if you cut the turkey open, remember I told you about the stomach, and you pull out the stomach of the turkey looks exactly like the stomach of a chicken. And they also have a crop at the base of their neck, which in the turkey and the chicken looks identical. So they look the same from, at least their kosher signs are the same. It also happens to be that the turkey has been consumed for many, many years. And it's not certain where the consumption of the turkey began. But it seems that it wasn't unanimous until pretty recently to require a tradition of permissibility. This was really became sort of the accepted tradition among the Jewish people, probably in the 1700s. It was written in the late 1600s. It was in the writings came, and it became accepted in the 1700s. And by that time, as you know, the first turkey arrived in Europe in, I think, 1532. So people have been eating turkey for generations already. So when they said we can only eat a bird that we know is kosher, people may have just assumed that the turkey was one of the birds that was grandfathered in. There's another view, which I think is comical, but I can't say it's serious. It happens to be, and everyone's heard of Darwin. I'm not a big fan of his, just because he's inaccurate. As you know, science catches itself. His work, but some of his ideas were pretty good. One of his adversaries, from an evolutionary standpoint, believed that the turkeys were indigenous to India, the Far East. And Darwin actually, I only know about this because Darwin attacks him, how ridiculous his theory is, how there's no way a turkey could survive in that environment. But it happens to be that if you look in the old Jewish sources, they also talk about a turkey being consumed since ancient times in the Far East. And what my theory is, and it's more than welcome to disagree because it's just my theory, if you take a look at the female peacock, which we know the Jews consumed at least since Talmudic times, probably since biblical times, Solomon, just for the record, he brought in birds from, he sent out ships. It's written about King Solomon in the Book of Kings, that he sent out ships to do far distance trade. And among the exotic animals he brought back was Tukiyim. And Tukiyim is defined by everybody as peacocks. It also happens to be that the ancient Tamil, in those days, the Tamil people, the ones who are being slaughtered now in Sri Lanka, they had a massive empire in southern India. And the Tamil word for peacocks happens to be Tuki. So you can see that perhaps Solomon did reach India, who knows. But the Jewish people were sure eating peacocks in Tamil times. The female peacock is very similar to the female turkey. And maybe there's a little bit of confusion there. And the Jews from India were saying, oh yeah, we've been eating that for generations, thinking people were asking about the peacock, when in fact the turkey was something they may have not even heard about. Any other questions? Yes?
Was allowed by the Masorah that didn't have signs?
Yes, duck and goose. There are four enclosures. Yeah, we eat them because we have a tradition that they're allowed. But it happens to be that if you cut open the goose, one of the four sons, Zol Kosher birds, have a crop. And geese do not have a crop.
So the real criteria is the story.
Correct. Brother Mark, any question?
Just before the 1700s, what exactly was the criteria?
So it's not clear. It seems that the criteria was probably something in terms of, see, before the 1700s, for those of you that are history majors, any history majors in the room? So you correct me if I'm wrong, but like in the 1700s, people started like getting to see the whole world, right? Suddenly the ships moved a little bit faster. You know, you didn't have to be a convict to make it across the ocean. You know, people would do that by their own free will. The world was changing. So before the 1700s, it was very rare that a new species was introduced. So you sort of saw this bird, and your grandfather saw the bird, and no one was surprised, even if you had to migrate because everyone was killing you. If they expelled the Jews from France and they went to Germany, how different were the birds there? So there weren't really a lot of questions as to what was a kosher bird, and in general, the birds they were discussing were all wild birds. So if you didn't know, you didn't eat it. So you're not going to go, you're not going to get to eat the, you know, who knows what. It wasn't a disaster. Whereas something like the turkeys, the New World birds that were domestic, when they were brought, if you didn't eat these new kinds of chickens that were being brought from Asia, if you didn't eat these new kinds of ducks that were domesticated by the South American Indians, then you had to pay more for your food. And if you happen to live in a shtetl, where people starve to death, paying a lot for your food was an extreme motivation to figure out if your bird was kosher or not. Okay? That was an honor for staff. All right, thank you very much for listening. You're welcome to come back and take a look at the birds.